Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Well, it's wonderful to be here today and to be speaking as part of this lecture series. And as we've just heard in the introduction, today I'm going to be talking about sexist humour. So I thought, well, I should probably start with a joke. But then I realised I'm a woman and a feminist, and society reliably informs me that I'm not very funny. Now, generally, humour is surrounded by positive connotations. We want to be around people with a good sense of humour, we enjoy being made to laugh, and we actively pursue opportunities to watch comedy, whether that's on TikTok or YouTube or Netflix specials. Because of this, when we begin to think about humour as potentially being offensive or harmful, it can be quite jarring. Yet given that a significant amount of humour places someone as the butt of the joke, or makes them the target of the humour, then actually I think we need to reflect on what it is that we find funny and why we find it funny. So today we're going to be focusing on sexist humour and humour that places women as the target. But there's some general questions that I think we want to consider in relation to the acceptability or the ethics of humour. So first, what is it actually acceptable to laugh at? Are there any subjects that we should never laugh at? Does it matter who tells the joke? Does the context affect the appropriateness of the humour? Is the intention behind the humour important? And what are the consequences of the humour? Now, whilst today is focused on sexist humour, I think a lot of what will be discussed is relevant to any humour that can be viewed as morally transgressive. We would still ask the same sorts of questions, and we would still consider the same sorts of impacts. So questions about the ethics of humour tend to relate to the idea of judgment. Judgment of the person who creates or shares the humour, judgment of the people who find the humour funny, and judgment of the object or subject of the humour. And all of these judgments have the potential to be positive or negative. They might adhere to religious, moral, or social norms, or they might transgress them. And in order to make these judgments, I think there are three considerations that we can make to help us evaluate the ethics of humour. First is the context that the humour takes place in. Second are the intentions behind the humour, and that might include the joke teller and the person or people laughing. And then finally, we need to consider the consequences. So in considering the context, it's often argued that who is telling the joke matters. Humour occurs within societal power structures, and as such, questions regarding the ethics of humour tend to have variable answers depending on who is creating the humour, who is laughing, and who is being laughed at. For example, is the joke teller a member of the targeted group or are they outside of it? Is the humour about shared experiences or not? Is the humour expecting us to laugh at someone or with someone? Now, we've all been the butt of the joke at different points in our lives, and we realise how uncomfortable it can be when we're the object of other people's laughter. So when we're assessing the ethics of humour, we often make a distinction between laughing at and with someone. We assume that maybe when we're laughing at someone, it's more unethical, but when we're laughing with someone, potentially, it's more acceptable. Where we laugh is also generally understood to affect the moral acceptability of humour. So a stand-up comedian telling a joke during a gig may be perceived very differently than if a stranger tells us that same joke at a bus stop. We discover the importance of context when we tell the same joke twice. Sometimes it can lead people to be in tucks of laughter, and other times we're faced with stony silence. The joke hasn't changed, but something in the context has. It's often assumed that there is a distinction between what is morally acceptable to laugh at in public and in private, but I'm not really convinced by this claim. Whilst laughing about a topic in private might feel more appropriate, it's certainly questionable that any fundamental change has occurred, and that the object of humour has actually shifted from the unethical to the ethical, simply because not many people are around to hear it. And bearing all this in mind, Ted Cohen explains that when we think about the context, not only will the joke work differently, if it works at all in different circumstances, but it may also, so to speak, change its meaning. So alongside context, when considering the appropriateness of humour, it's important to think about the intention or message behind the humour. Ronald D'Souza explains that what gives offence usually does so in virtue of its motivational origins. So if we believe that a joke teller has malintent, then we're more likely to be offended by the joke. Of course, there can be a misunderstanding about the joke teller's intentions. We can perceive malintent where there is none, or we can fail to recognise malintent when it's present. If intention is important, we need to consider if there is a difference between someone who makes an off-the-cuff quip that is deemed offensive, as opposed to someone who, say, intentionally writes a text, draws a cartoon, produces a video, or performs a comedy set. We tend to be more forgiving if someone slips up than if they plan the content that causes offence, because in planning the content, there's plenty of time to reflect on its appropriateness, and any failure to reflect appears morally dubious. Now, whenever we consider ethical issues, we're often concerned with consequences, whether they're real or simply possible. But what are the consequences of humour? Can humour harm? In recognising that offensive jokes can lead some people to experience negative emotions, such as upset, shock, embarrassment, disgust, and offence, some argue, well, why would we want to make people feel that way? Surely we should just avoid telling those jokes in the first place. Some argue, well, humour doesn't have material consequences, and so we shouldn't take it seriously. It's certainly not as serious as words that lead to physical harm. The potential for someone to be offended, they argue, is an insufficient reason not to tell a joke. It could also be argued that the gravity of the consequences of humour vary on who is the target, whether the target of the laughter is a hegemonic majority or a disenfranchised minority. So whether the target is part of a dominant social group or a marginalised minority. Is the joke attempting to empower people or to marginalise and oppress them? As we'll come to see, being the butt of the joke can be part of a wider pattern of oppressive behaviour, rather than simply a standalone event. Now, if we bear all of these things in mind, so the context, the intentions, and the consequences, it becomes apparent that invoking humour is always ethically unpredictable. Though perhaps with sexist humour, which we'll now turn our attention to, its unethical nature is more predictable than other instances of humour. So generally, humour is believed to result from the expectations, norms, and ideals of a particular social group. As such, jokes reflect dominant social attitudes, and that includes the good bits and the bad bits. Julie Weber and her colleagues explain that whether the jokesters, the jokes they tell, or the implications for those laughing, comedy is always an expression of values, and we mustn't forget that despite mouthfuls of laughter. So in the case of sexist humour or jokes, we see how these jokes target an individual or a group as a result of their gender. Sexist jokes can target any gender, though more often women are the object or butt of the joke. And so that will be the focus today. So when we look at sexist jokes, we often see that they carry sentiments that imply women are inferior to men, or they diminish women in some way. They draw on stereotypes and derogatory depictions. So generally, content of the jokes may make reference to traditional gender roles that imply women belong in the kitchen, stereotypes that women are over-emotional and or must be on their period if they don't respond in a socially expected way, or in the case of blonde jokes, that women are unintelligent. Essentially, in sexist jokes, we witness sexism disguised as a joke. Though it is important to remember that when telling sexist jokes, it's not the preserve of men. Plenty of women also tell sexist jokes too. So when a sexist joke is identified and agreed to be inappropriate, it is often suggested that the person telling the sexist joke is to blame. They're just an anomaly in society, a bad apple. But actually, I think we need to pay more attention to the frequency of these jokes, because if we see the frequent telling of sexist jokes, then surely this is reflecting dominant attitudes within a society that need to be both recognised and addressed. If sexist jokes continue to be told, that's because sexism remains a part of our society, and the sexist jokes forms examples of everyday sexism. So we can briefly consider the importance of context, intentions, and consequences in relation to blonde jokes, which is a particular form of sexist humour. So consider if I, as a blonde woman, told the following blonde joke. Why did the blonde creep past the medicine cabinet? Because she didn't want to wake the sleeping pills. So, whether you find the joke funny or offensive will depend on how you interpret the joke. Let's assume, and there was a stony silence then, which might have been a result of my delivery or awkwardness given the topic of today's lecture, but let's assume you did view it as offensive. Would that joke be less offensive if someone who wasn't a blonde told it? Would it make a difference if I wasn't a university lecturer or, shock, I'm not a natural blonde? Assuming I told this joke in the context other than this lecture on the ethics of humour, so maybe I told it off the cuff, or maybe I thought, oh, I'm going to tell a student that before class. Would that affect the reception of the joke? What if I only told that joke in the presence of other blonde women? What if I offered a caveat that I didn't mean any malintent in telling that joke? Would it matter if I was being self-deprecating? Did you recognise the stereotypes at play in that joke? And did that recognition stop you from laughing? In telling that joke, have I just contributed to the judgments and sexist attitudes that blonde women already encounter? Should we take jokes such as those seriously? So sexist jokes allow prejudice towards women to be expressed, often without consequences, because it's not believed to be as harmful as those same sentiments being expressed seriously, or as harmful as physical acts of violence. Studies have shown that sexist jokes are also less likely to be confronted than more explicit acts of sexism, and so they continue to circulate and reinforce sexist and misogynistic views. Attempts to resist sexist humour, particularly when vocalised by women, often lead to allegations of being uptight, a killjoy, or lacking a sense of humour. And all of this feeds into the enduring myth that women are not and cannot be funny. Now, there are various reasons for this myth, and one example is the role that women have played in humorous anecdotes, jokes, and stories. Because a great deal of comedy positions women as the butt of the joke, and understandably many women don't want to laugh at that when they're the object of the humour, there's this recurring attitude that women are humourless. We also notice when we look back through the history books that there aren't really many records of women's humour throughout history. You have to look really hard to find them. And although this is now declining in contemporary Western society, historically, there was an expectation that women would be at home. They wouldn't be frequenting bars and comedy clubs. But whilst women might not have been performing stand-up comedy, they were still engaging in humour in private, often in the absence of men. Watch a group of women together, and you're sure to see them laughing. Perhaps also feminine humour is only viewed as not humorous because it's being upheld against the standards of masculine humour, and so it will never be the same. Now, as a result of the purported lack of humour, women have often found themselves excluded from the public comic realm. There's lots of assumptions about the suitability of women in these spaces. Now, this might be based on the belief that ladies should be ladies, and ladies do not laugh. They just smile politely. It could be the perception that good girls don't understand the sexual content of men's jokes, and so they can't and they shouldn't engage in that humour. Or maybe it's that women are just too nice. They won't like the aggressive, satirical, or ridiculing nature of most humour. Now, these gendered expectations are changing, and we've begun to realise that women are more than targets of humour. They can be agents and audiences. Perhaps the tables are turning. Humour has and continues to be weaponised in moments of political conflict and resistance. Maybe this is why we see some women attempting to reclaim humour as a tool and perhaps even a weapon of their own. Now, in much the same way that we see the myth that women are not and cannot be funny continue, we also see the view that feminists are serious, dour, and humourless. Women are frequently positioned as the reluctant object of men's jokes, and their feminist endeavours, whether that be choosing not to laugh at a misogynistic joke or their fight for equal rights, leads them to be labelled as killjoys. In fact, if anyone's familiar with Sara Ahmed's latest book, The Feminist Killjoy Handbook, she includes a killjoy maxim, which reads, when it's not funny, do not laugh. She's identifying a power in the withdrawal of our laughter. It draws attention to the issue, and in choosing not to laugh, we're sending a message. So the accusations of being humourless, lacking a sense of humour, and not getting the joke are deemed, or at least intended, to be hurtful. And the fact that attempts are made to overcome this stereotyping is telling of the importance that contemporary society places on attributes such as having a sense of humour and being funny. So as Bobby Duffy was explaining in his lecture a few weeks ago, what is or isn't offensive often differs among different generations, and it's no different when we consider humour. There is often a fine line between what we laugh at and what we deem offensive. What is and isn't deemed appropriate to laugh at changes from one generation to the next, but it also changes amongst nationalities, genders, sexualities, ethnicities, and races. There is a subjectiveness to the acceptability or morality of our humour. And this shifts and changes in different societies, at different times, and for different individuals. If we go way back into history to ancient Greek society, we see that Aristotle, who was interested in the ethics of comedy, advised people that we should jest, meaning joke, that we should jest with good taste. But then he realized that he probably needed to explain what he meant by good taste, and that's where the problem arose. So Aristotle added the caveat that defining good taste is challenging, if not impossible, because tastes differ on what is offensive and what is amusing. So essentially today, we're still tackling the problem that Aristotle raised all those years ago. Now, although most people have general precepts or guidelines that they follow when considering the appropriateness of humour and what they choose to laugh about or at, the challenge is that sometimes it can come as a surprise that we've crossed a line we hadn't anticipated. What we find funny might differ from our friends, our family, our colleagues, and strangers. And Ted Cohen advises that there is no formula to tell us which jokes are offensive or when it is the wrong time to put forth a particular joke. whilst this is probably true, I do think there are definitely clues that we can pick up on, especially if we're about to engage in morally transgressive humour. So in considering the ethics of humour, we can wonder if it is even possible to offer prescriptions or rules about what we should and shouldn't laugh at. Can we claim that it is only morally acceptable to laugh with and not at people? That our laughter should always be directed at those in power rather than the marginalised? That certain subjects are always off limits and unlaughable? Or will such ethical guidelines be positioned as impractical or lacking nuance? In considering where or even whether to draw the line, some people believe that we should be able to laugh at anything and that we have the right to use humour to offend others. For example, Rowan Atkinson once claimed that there should be no subject about which you cannot make jokes. In my view, the right to offend is far more important than any right not to be offended. But is this going too far? So earlier we started to consider the consequences of humour, and the extent of the harm caused by humour has been long debated. In part, the challenge for evidencing harm is that the consequences of humour may not be immediate, visible, or material. There is a tendency to position physical harm as more damaging than mental or emotional harm. The ethics of a joke are often reduced to discussions of offence, the experience of negative emotions following a perceived transgression of social, moral, or maybe legal expectations. And whilst we'll return to offence in a moment, perhaps the most important harmful consequence to recognise is that morally transgressive humour is often part of a wider pattern of oppressive behaviour. Mary Bergman, in her consideration of sexist humour, which was written in the 1980s but is actually still very relevant today, she argues that whilst a sexist joke may be positioned as harmless, it is not harmless because it is not an isolated event in which a woman is harmlessly teased or ridiculed. It is rather one instance among many in which women are belittled or disparaged. So unlike situations when the joking is restricted to a moment in time, sexist humour does not end once the joke has been told. Joking is instead part of a wider pattern of sexist behaviour that women must endure. In addition to this, when we tell and share sexist jokes, there's evidence to suggest that this promotes sexist prejudice, because we're continuing to use problematic language or demeaning ideas that reinforce traditional gender roles and stereotypes. When a sexist joke is told and faces no consequences, it implies that sexist attitudes will be tolerated in that specific context, and so it can make women feel unwelcome in those spaces. When you're in the workplace and a senior member of staff tells an offensive joke, studies have found that junior colleagues tend to laugh along. And this isn't because they agree with the sentiments of the joke, but because they say they fear repercussions by isolating themselves if they choose not to laugh along. However, when you or a member of your group is the object of laughter, the laughter of colleagues and their refusal to stand up and say something can feel like an endorsement of the sentiments of the joke. Studies have shown that when women oppose sexist humour, this is likely to make their situation worse. They will become the object of criticism and ridicule. However, when men raise concerns with sexist humour, it's also been found that this is more likely to lead to behavioural changes in the joke teller. So if the joke teller is more likely to respond to the feedback from a man than a woman, it could be suggestive of the fact that the sexist undertones of the joke are much more deeply present in their everyday thinking. It really wasn't just a joke. Perhaps even more worryingly, studies have shown that exposure to sexist jokes leads men to demonstrate more sexist attitudes and behaviours, which include feeling free to openly express their antagonism towards women, feeling distant from women and unwilling to offer support when asked, And the example in one study was that when men were shown neutral jokes and asked to donate to a women's charity, the majority made a donation. But when they'd been exposed to sexist jokes, the majority chose not to make a donation to the women's charity when asked. There's also been findings that men express more tolerance after hearing a sexist joke when they then go on to hear about sexism that was directed towards an individual woman. And even that there's a proclivity and an openness to expressing violence towards women. So what we see here is that the prevalence of sexist humour creates, condones and perpetuates prejudices, stereotypes, and both harmful attitudes and behaviours. The negative effects of humour extend beyond the telling of the joke, and there are real-world consequences. So, Mary Bergman offers an analogy that I think can be helpful for evaluating the morality of sexist humour. She explains that when we see someone slip on a banana skin, we only find it funny when we know that the person is not hurt. We isolate our comic amusement from that person's pain and suffering. However, she argues that sexist humour is like choosing to intentionally drop the banana peel in the path of someone, knowing that they're going to trip and fall. In this case, if we laugh at them falling over, then we can't isolate the person's pain from our comic amusement, nor can we isolate our responsibility for their pain. She says that the same applies to sexist humour. Just as the banana peel is a necessary condition for the comedy, sexist stereotypes or beliefs are a necessary condition for sexist humour. And just as the person who intentionally places the banana peel in someone's path bears responsibility for the subsequent fall and the pain they endure, the joker who tells a sexist joke bears responsibility for the harm caused through their use of sexist stereotypes or beliefs. To enjoy the fall or to enjoy the sexist humour is dependent on finding fun in something that hurts someone else. So given the general sense that prejudice should be condemned, people tend to believe that their behaviour, including the humour they enjoy and laugh at, does not fly in the face of this attitude. So it's for this reason that many people will deny that they're laughing at a joke that is derogatory towards women is sexist, or that they are sexist because they laughed along. When jokes are told, there are social rules that the hearer of the joke is expected to follow. And when they don't follow these rules or conventions, then problematic social exchanges occur. So, as I'm sure you know, when a joke is told, you're expected to smile, laugh, maybe groan if it's a bad joke. But what you're not meant to do is to point out that there's some offensive undertones or sentiments within the joke. You're meant to bypass those and laugh along. However, the reality is that there will be moments when someone says something that they intend to be funny, but that you really can't see the humour in. You find it offensive, and so you don't laugh. And this refusal to laugh is an outward indication of your disapproval. It's a refusal to accept the norms presupposed in the humour. Now, when someone is challenged for telling an offensive joke, when someone is told that they have said or done something that isn't funny, or that they shouldn't be laughing along because something is offensive, a common rebuttal is that they were just joking, or that it was just a joke. And in fact, just joking is said to be one of the most common phrases in the English language. And I know it's a phrase I've used, and I'm sure it's a phrase you've all used too. But the claim that someone was just joking is often believed to neutralize the challenge and to provide an absolution of moral responsibility. There seems to be an underlying belief that the joke teller is not responsible for the joke content. But can we and should we absolve the individual from moral responsibility? Dennis Hauer and Kwame Owusu-Bempa argue that the phrase just joking is a device by which the teller of the joke essentially refuses to change the message and instead passes the responsibility for the conversational difficulty to the challenger for not having a sense of humour. It also leads the joke teller to reject any need to reflect on what they have said, to recognise the offence caused and to change their thinking or behaviour. The joke and the offence incurred is the problem of the offended party. Now, the just joking defence implies that if something is surrounded by alleged humour, it can't be genuinely offensive. But often jokes contain people's beliefs about others, perhaps a presumed superiority of one gender over another in the case of sexist humour. Jokes harness negative stereotypes for alleged comic effect, and to use the same stereotypes in serious conversations, so outside of the joke form, would lead to outcry. And yet within the form of the joke, they elicit not anger, but comic amusement. Importantly for Howitt and Owusu-Bempa, jokes do more than merely reflect prejudices. They are active in the process of the construction of the meaning of otherness and inferiority of social groups. So joking reinforces prejudices. People laugh at sexist humour because they recognise the stereotypes at play. But do they have to believe them to laugh? Think back to the blonde joke that I told earlier. Were you noting the stereotypes at play? If you think honestly about them, did you believe them or do you believe them? And perhaps your answer to those questions shows whether you had a desire to laugh or not. In the case of morally transgressive jokes, some argue that whilst jokes are conditional, so it's not essential that an audience believe the stereotype, but they do need to be aware of the stereotype in question. Others say that the idea being here that we can be aware of stereotypes but not believe them, and so that's why we find the joke funny. Here, joking is positioned as belonging to the imagination, and thus intentions are based on fictional rather than real attitudes. However, others are unconvinced by this, and they believe that our laughter is often based on the manifestation of real attitudes and behaviours, and that our laughter reflects our innate prejudices. In a sense, our laughter unveils the thing that we keep hidden before we've had time to control it. Now, when we're accused of crossing the line, as we've seen, our response tends to be more concerned with putting the responsibility for the offence onto the offended party, or becoming concerned with the label that we'll receive, such as being labelled as racist or sexist, depending on the joke that we laugh at. Perhaps if we reflect on the content of the joke, the implications of the joke, and consider whether we really want to be promoting these ideas, stereotypes, and prejudices, then we would take more responsibility for what we laugh at. The reality is that sometimes morally transgressive humour can be very funny, and even if we don't want to admit it, we've all laughed at something that we shouldn't have. I'm not trying to tell you what you should or shouldn't laugh at, or what jokes you should or shouldn't tell. I know that reflecting on what we laugh at can certainly take the fun out of it. Trust me, I do it for a job. But that doesn't mean that it's not something we should do. After today, maybe, just maybe, you'll think twice before you tell your next joke. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.